Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is J.R. Moehringer, author of the heartbreaking and funny memoir, The Tender Bar, published by Hyperion. In the weeks to come, we have Neil Gaiman reading from his smash hit, Anansi Boys, Robert Hicks and his best-selling, The Widow of the South, and Susanna Clarke discusses her international bestseller, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell. You can visit www.tatteredcover.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Just a moment. I think I see J.R. Moehringer coming up to the podium. It's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tattered Cover this evening. I'm Joyce Meskis, and I welcome you all, and I am here to introduce the introducer. Our guest introducer tonight has been formerly best known, perhaps, as a geologist, brewpub starter extraordinaire, and developer and businessman. However, few know the fact that he has really, really deep literary roots, with a degree in English literature from Wesleyan University, as well as dipping his toe into the roiling waters of authorship himself. Now, currently, he's best known as a public servant. Well-read, well-versed, well-spoken, our mayor of the city and county of Denver, with just an extraordinary approval rating, I might add, John Hickenlooper.
Thank you, Joyce. Thank you very much. And this introduction of this evening's author is going to be so long that I'm glad that was so short, so that there's some time left for J.R. to speak. Because I knew J.R. back in those pivotal years of 1990 to 1994 when he was in Denver. That's right, years, right?
That's right.
And we hung out a little. We actually played squash on occasion. And I first met him when he came. We had just opened the Wine Coop Brewing Company, and he did a couple of columns, one in 1991, one in 1993. I'm very grateful to Bill Houston for actually pulling these clips up. But he had a willing allegiance to other heroic writers in those days. And since no one can tell me not to, I thought I would read a little bit of the clip from 1993, although the 91 one's almost better. But this is the beginning of the, and the subheading was, "You Are All a Lost Generation," Gertrude Stein, just to give you some sense of his pretension. And this was the wine coop used to, when we take our spent grain, we'd give it to pig farmers, and for our anniversary, we would bring down a half a dozen or a dozen pigs, and we would kind of walk them around the block and call it the running of the pigs. Actually, I think Bill Houston himself called it Pamplona on the Platte. Anyway, J.R. was at that time a staff writer for the Rocky Mountain News, and he wrote, and I'm starting from the beginning, "The pig stepped in something and went down hard. The crowd watched him lie there, snorting and refusing to get up, like a man on a sofa when Saturday comes. Everyone stared in horror at the pig's dangerous snout, which could not gore a man but sure could kill an appetite. Smeared with breakfast and its aftermath, the snout looked like death in the afternoon, and the pig pointed it at the people in a menacing gesture that said, 'If this is how humans spend their weekends, truly it is good to be a pig.' At least 50 humans were on hand to see the third annual running of the pigs. The running is a way for downtown's Wine Coop Brewing Company to mark its birthday every year. Also, it's a way for reporters with literary pretensions to madden editors by writing ridiculously macho prose on deadline in imitation of the great one, Ernest Hemingway." And let me say, it goes on at some length, which I will spare you. The other thing, when the Denver Public Library opened, Wine Coop and another exercise in literary pretension, decided that we would gather 12 writers together and we would have something called Denver Public Libation. And we would get writers to write brief pieces on beer bottles. And we went back into the computers and pulled out the original script and put it back on the beer labels, front and back. So we have two bottles. I brought two so that JR could read along as I read. And this is, and it is relevant, if those of you who haven't read the book, it clearly is relevant to the book. This is called I-25, a story by J.R. Moringer. Some fathers hit the road, mine flogged it. He left before I cut my first tooth, visiting only once or twice in my imagination. I tracked him here to Denver when I was 17, made him meet me for a beer, and asked him the $64 question, "The hell you been?" He jerked his head toward the lollipop-colored liquor bottles behind the bar. "Regrettably," he said, his voice, like this Shakespeare actor I once saw, "these have been my surrogate sons." He died before I could punch him in the mouth. I've drifted a lot since then, and today I drifted back to Denver, back to this same bar. Through the front windows, the snow-covered mountains looked like a mahogany headboard with fresh white pillows propped up against it, meaning I must be more tired than I thought. Haven't had a drink in 12 days, which is why I sound this way. But don't think I'm down. Drinking coffee in a great city, feeling superior to your old man's memory, that's all any son asks of life. I like Colorado. I like the way I-25 runs straight down its middle. In fact, I just now realized I'm 25. I'm 25, and my father cut me in two, just like I-25 does Colorado. One rocky half, one smooth. Just realized something else. After meeting my father that day, I wandered over to the Denver Public Library and checked out the collected words of William Goddamn Shakespeare. You know, I think I could put my head down on this bar and let it all out right here, right now, because you have to figure me and that book are something like 8 years overdue. J.R. wandered a little bit after he left Denver. He went to work for the Los Angeles Times, originally as a reporter in their Orange County edition, which is sort of like the minor leagues working your way up, from 1994 to 1997. Went off to become the Atlanta bureau chief in 1997, and has since come back to Denver as a national correspondent. His awards include the Scripps Howard National Non-Deadline Writer of the Year, 1992, which is really an award for someone they want to give an award to but couldn't think of something more suitable. But from there, he went on to the Associated Press News Executives Council Feature Writing Award of 1997, the Penn Center USA West 1997 Literary Award, the Livingston Award for Young Journalists 1997, and the Pulitzer Prize for Feature Writing Finalist 1998. I think when you look at how the ability of people's of individuals to impact their world and by their thoughts and how they put them on paper, JR is someone who has gone far beyond what most people would ever dream of. And, you know, I've certainly gone way beyond what I dreamed with, and there are only a few people who I would happily exchange paths with. And I think what JR has lived and what he has made of himself is something that we can all admire, and certainly I am more than a little envious of. I have in front of me the September 25th, 2005 New York Times bestsellers review, and number 13th on the I'll tell you, he wasn't that good a squash player. But he is a hell of a great person. There's a reception following the signing at Steak au Poivre, 212 Milwaukee, where JR will hold forth at great length until he passes out. Thank you all for coming. Mr. JR Moringer.
That was easy on you.
Yeah, there you were. The last time I spoke to a group this large in Denver was my last day at the Rocky Mountain News. I managed to offend the half of the newsroom that didn't hate me that day. But the Rocky Mountain News is where I made a big discovery about writing. I fell victim as a kid to the idea that writing is this solitary craft. that people practice in dark garrets and late at night. And that's a lot of crap. It's a collaborative art. It's like quilting. And I learned that at the Rocky. Your friends, your editors, your photographers, graphic designers, booksellers, they stand ready to help you tell your story to the world if you just get over yourself and let them. And that lesson applies to my relationship with Denver, too, because I realize on nights like tonight that this is one of my hometowns. I didn't ever choose to live here, but twice I've come here. And I'll have more to say about that in a second, but so many people here helped me write this book. The mayor here is my first publisher. That excerpt that he had me read from the beer bottle, that's the first time I ever tried to write The Tender Bar. And I remember that it came out in a rush one day. I was too stupid to know what I was doing, and I was on deadline for this stupid beer bottle that the owner of Wincoop Brewing Company was going to try and put short stories on the label. And I said, all right, well, let me just try and tell the truth. And suddenly it just started flowing. I'd been trying to write in a million different voices, and that day suddenly I-25 came out, and then I didn't try to do that again for a very long time. But that beer label is really the prologue, unlike the prologue that I'm going to read you tonight, of this book. And the owner of this bar where I grew up, if he had lived to know that the first thing I ever wrote about him or this bar was printed on a beer label, he would have died laughing. I look around this room, I see faces of people who have helped me write this book, collaborators. And I want to mention a few. Joe Rosenfoss, for example. People like Joe don't even know how much they helped me write this book. Joe would talk dirty to me every Sunday night. We would have this regularly scheduled chat, and Joe would say the most filthy things on the phone. And it would make me laugh so much on Sunday night after a long week locked in my basement that I would kind of loosen up. And then the next day, I'd be kind of ready to go again. And then the following week, I could count on Joe to call and say the most scatological, filthy things again. Ostensibly, the chat was supposed to be about football. But it was really about Joe making me laugh and loosening me up. It was, you know, a big part of this book, and Joe never knew until tonight, until I could tell all of you. Bill Husted, would feed me a steak every once in a while when I was waning, when I was losing hope. He called me when Saddam Hussein was arrested, and he said, Mohringer, when are they going to pull you out of your spider hole? And it made me laugh all through the writer's block of that day and that evening. He would have me come out and watch him drink a martini to relax every once in a while. As you may know, if you've made it to the end of my book, I don't drink anymore. But I would get loose as an overcooked noodle watching Bill. And it was good research to remember what people look like after they've had a martini. So Bill doesn't even know how helpful he's been to this book. And he'll forget tomorrow, but that's not the point. I'm delighted to have here Virginia Valentine, who saw me browsing in the tattered cover 10 years ago, standing at the fiction section, and I wasn't looking for something to read. I was praying that someday I could add something to this incredible conversation going on at this wall. But she didn't know that, and she came up and she asked if she could recommend something. And I said yes, and so she said, "You must read this." And she handed me Jim Salter's Sport and a Pastime, which I read overnight, and I came back and I thanked her more than I've ever thanked anybody for a book recommendation. Just on my knees said, thank you for teaching me, for showing me. And she said, well, why don't you call him and tell him how much you like the book? So she handed me a scrap of paper with his phone number. And I went up to Aspen on the pretext of interviewing him. I think he even knew that wasn't true. And we sat by this window at a restaurant in Aspen with the snow falling. And he gave me a five-hour tutorial in writing, in keeping the faith, in keeping hope when all seems lost in the middle of a book. We talked about women and war, and at the end of the conversation, I said, I don't really think I can write about you. And he said, yeah, I kind of figured that this was just a tutorial. And because of Virginia Valentine and that night, that's why Jim Salter is on the back of this book. I could go on and on in this room. So many of you have stopped me. Jackie Brown, is she out there? Jackie Brown read an early draft and was so loving and so sweet and just gave me the encouragement I needed. And at Jackie Brown's father's funeral, we talked about this book. And she talked with her sisters about it. And it gave them something else to talk about briefly and something to look forward to. And it was a great primer in what a book can be at a tough moment. And I went back to my writing table that night with renewed vigor. And I'm sure Jackie doesn't realize how important a moment that was. Her bravery and the lovely things she said about my book that night propelled me, gave me wind in my sails for another 2 weeks. So many of you have stopped me on the street and said, "What? How's the writing coming?" And I've had to tell you, you know, and then you've said, "Well, what's the book about again?" And you've helped me kind of hone my ideas with your boredom and your impatience. But honestly, you know, it's good practice when you're at Campo and Josh Hanflin introduces you to somebody and says, "JR's writing a memoir," and that somebody says, "Oh, about who?" At first, it brings you up short, but then you realize, well, you know, maybe I should tell her. It's not just about me. It's about these guys who helped raise me. It's a memoir with someone other than me who's the hero, and that's my mother. So Kathy Langer used to see me walking into the store, and in Virginia Valentine fashion, she observed me scowling at the memoirs, you know, kind of sizing up my competition. And she knew what I was up to, because only weirdos in trench coats come here and scowl at the memoir section. And she was discreet enough not to come up to me and ask if she could get me a chair or a glass of water. She knew what I was up to, but she gave me my space and only told me after the book was out and we were all having dinner with my publisher in New York that she had been observing me and that she was happy that I had found whatever I needed from staring at that wall of memoirs. Patty Thorne, is she here tonight? Patty wrote one of the first substantial things about the book, and my publisher marks that as a huge day in the life of this book because it just went everywhere. Who knew? The Scripps Howard News Service. And people read this and suddenly started jumping on this bandwagon, but Patty was the one who put the wheels on the bandwagon and said such lovely things. And also, when we talked that day in Barnes & Noble, it's still the best interview I've had, and I've had some good ones and I've had some really awful ones, but Patty was the best and was so interested and couldn't write fast enough and asked all the best questions. Lastly, I wanted to mention Marty Midas, who saw me at a cocktail party. Where is she? Saw me at a cocktail party a few years ago and said, "I heard you're writing a book." I said, "Yeah, I am." And she said, "What's it about?" So I said, "Well, it's about this bar in New York where I grew up, and all these guys in the bar, these soldiers and poets and actors and lawyers, were my surrogate father." And she said, "What's the second paragraph?" So at the time, that felt like a pole axe over the head. But, you know, it was a good reminder that people have an attention span that short. Because I did go back and I cut out a lot of the prologue that night. I said, "Screw this, man. You got about a half a heartbeat to get people's attention." And, you know, at the time I wanted to slap her. But now, tonight, I'm publicly thanking her. So that's how things are going for this book. This book, in recent reviews, has been called a love letter to the people who helped to raise me. And it is that. But it's also a thank you letter. And that's what I wanted to, when I was thinking about what I was going to say tonight, I really wanted to say thank you to all of you. I can't thank you each by name. I'll be happy to thank you later, individually, at Steak au Poivre, maybe. But the book is very much in the spirit of thanksgiving and gratitude. And when I think of Denver, I think of a place where I was not born, but I was reborn twice. And the bar taught me that you really don't choose places, they choose you. And Denver chose me, and I'm very, very grateful for that choice. So tonight is a wonderful chance for me to tell you thank you. And to maybe read, do we have time, or would we rather do questions? You've either read the book, or you haven't read the book. If you've read the book, why do you need anyone to read it to you? And if you haven't read it, why would I want to spoil a part that So, I mean, readings never make any sense to me, and I've seen some bad ones. But having said that, is there a groundswell in the...
Please read.
Okay. I will read you just a little bit of the beginning, which is the most important part of the book other than the end. The beginning is... I wish I could take credit for that, but my cousin McGraw... Read the second paragraph. Okay. I'll read page 137. Would all the children leave the room, please? The sex scene is coming up. The prologue is, this is the prologue of a journalist. I couldn't write a book without a nut graph. This is the lead. But it's also, it's the Cliff Notes version. I like to call it the Marty Midas section. It's what you need to know. And I'll read you sort of an abbreviated version of it, if you insist. We went there for everything we needed. We went there when thirsty, of course, and when hungry, and when dead tired. We went there when happy to celebrate, and when sad to sulk. We went there after weddings and funerals for something to settle our nerves, and always for a shot of courage just before. We went there when we didn't know what we needed, hoping someone might tell us. We went there when looking for love or sex or trouble, or for someone who had gone missing, because sooner or later everyone turned up there. Most of all, we went there when we needed to be found. My personal list of needs was long. An only child abandoned by my father, I needed a family, a home, and men, especially men. I needed men as mentors, heroes, role models, and as a kind of masculine counterweight to my mother, grandmother, aunt, and 5 female cousins with whom I lived. The bar provided me with all the men I needed and 1 or 2 men who were the last thing I needed. Long before it legally served me, the bar saved me. It restored my faith when I was a boy, tended me as a teenager, and when I was a young man, the bar embraced me. While I fear that we're drawn to what abandons us and to what seems most likely to abandon us, in the end, I believe, we're defined by what embraces us. Naturally, I embraced the bar right back, until one night the bar turned me away, and in that final abandonment, the bar saved my life. There had always been a bar on that corner, by one name or another, since the beginning of time, or the end of Prohibition, which were the same thing in my hard-drinking hometown, Manhasset, Long Island. In the 1930s, the bar was a stop-off for movie stars on their way to the nearby yacht clubs and posh ocean resorts. In the 1940s, the bar was a haven for soldiers coming home from the wars. In the 1950s, the bar was a lounge for greasers and their poodle-skirted girlfriends. But the bar didn't become a landmark, a patch of hallowed ground, until 1970, when Steve bought the place and renamed it Dickens. Above the door, Steve hung a silhouette of Charles Dickens, and below the silhouette, he spelled out the name in old English lettering, Dickens. Such a blatant display of Anglophilia didn't sit well with every Kevin Flynn and Michael Gallagher in Manhasset. They let it slide only because they so thoroughly approved of Steve's cardinal rule of the barroom, every third drink free. Also, it helped that Steve hired 7 or 8 members of the O'Malley clan to bus his tables, and that he took pains to make Dickens look as though it had been shipped brick by brick from County Donegal. Steve intended his bar to look like a European public house, but to feel quintessentially American, an honest-to-God house for the public, his public. In the heart of Manhasset, a pastoral suburb of 8,000 people, 17 miles southeast of Manhattan, Steve wanted to create a sanctuary where his neighbors and friends and fellow drinkers, and especially his high school buddies coming home from Vietnam, could savor a feeling of safety and return. In every venture, Steve was confident of success. Confidence was his most attractive quality and his tragic flaw. But with Dickens, he surpassed his greatest expectations. Manhasset quickly came to see Steve's bar as the bar. Just as we said the city to mean New York City and the street to mean Wall Street, we always said the bar, presumptively, and there was never any confusion about which bar we meant. Then, imperceptibly, Dickens became something more than the bar. It became the place, the preferred shelter from all life storms. In 1979, when the nuclear reactor at 3 Mile Island melted down and fear of apocalypse swept the Northeast, many Manhassetites phoned Steve to reserve space in the airtight basement below his bar. Of course, everyone had their own basements, but there was just something about Dickens. People thought of it first whenever doomsday loomed. Along with Sanctuary, Steve provided nightly lessons in democracy, or the special plurality of alcohol. Standing in the middle of his barroom, you could watch men and women from all strata of society educating and abusing one another. You could hear the poorest man in town discussing market volatility with the president of the New York Stock Exchange, or the local librarian lecturing a New York Yankees Hall of Famer about the wisdom of choking up on the bat. You could hear a feeble-minded porter say something so off the wall and yet so wise that a college philosophy professor would jot it on a napkin and tuck it in his pocket. You could hear bartenders, in between making bets and mixing pink squirrels, talk like philosopher kings. Steve believed the corner bar to be the most egalitarian of all American gathering places, and he knew that Americans have always venerated their bars, saloons, taverns, and gin mills, one of his favorite expressions. He knew that Americans invest their bars with meaning and turn to them for everything from glamour to succor, and above all for relief from that scourge of modern life, loneliness. He didn't know that Puritans, upon landing in the New World, built a bar even before they built a church. He didn't know that American bars descend directly from the medieval inns of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, which descended from the Saxon alehouses, which descended from the taverni along the roads of ancient Rome. Steve's bar could trace its lineage all the way back to the painted caves of Western Europe, where Stone Age elders initiated young boys and girls into the ways of the tribe nearly 15,000 years ago. Though Steve didn't know these things, he sensed them in his blood and enacted them in everything he did. More than most men, Steve appreciated the importance of place, and on the cornerstone of this principle, he was able to build a bar so strange and shrewd and beloved and wondrously in tune with its customers that it came to be known well beyond Manhasset. My hometown was famous for two things, lacrosse and liquor. Year in, year out, Manhasset produced a disproportionate number of superb lacrosse players and a still greater number of distended livers. Some people also knew Manhasset as the backdrop for The Great Gatsby. While composing portions of his masterpiece, F. Scott Fitzgerald sat on a breezy veranda in Great Neck and gazed across Manhasset Bay at our town, which he turned into the fictional East Egg, a historic distinction that gave our bowling alley and pizzeria a certain archaeological grandeur. We strode each day across Fitzgerald's abandoned stage set. We romanced one another among his ruins. It was a kick, an honor, but like Steve's bar, it was merely an offshoot of Manhasset's famous fondness for drink. Anyone familiar with Manhasset understood why liquor surged through Fitzgerald's novel like the Mississippi across a floodplain. Men and women throwing raucous parties and boozing until they blacked out or ran someone down with their car sounded to us like a typical Tuesday night in Manhasset. Of course, many bars in Manhasset, like bars everywhere, were nasty places full of pickled people marinating in regret. Steve wanted his bar to be different. He wanted his bar to be sublime. He envisioned a bar that would cater to Manhasset's multiple personalities, a cozy pub one minute, a crazy after-hours joint the next. A family restaurant early in the evening and late at night, a low-down tavern where men and women could tell lies and drink until they dropped. Essential to Steve was the idea that Dickens would be the opposite of the outside world, cool in the dog days, warm from the first frost until spring. His bar would always be clean and well-lighted, like the den of that perfect family we all believe exists but doesn't and never did. At Dickens, everyone would feel special, though no one would stand out. Maybe my favorite story about Steve's bar concerned the man who found his way there after escaping a nearby mental hospital. No one looked askance at the man. No one asked who he was, or why he was dressed in pajamas, or why he had such a feral gleam in his eye. The gang in the barroom simply threw their arms around him, told him funny stories, and bought him drinks all day long. The only reason the poor man was eventually asked to leave was that he suddenly and for no apparent reason dropped his pants. Even then, the bartenders only chided him gently, using their standard admonition. Here now, you can't be doing that. Like love affairs, bars depend on a delicate mix of timing, chemistry, lighting, luck, and maybe above all, generosity. From the start, Steve declared that no one at Dickens would feel slighted. His burgers would be 3-inch soufflés of filet mignon, his closing time would be negotiable, no matter what the law said, and his bartenders would give an extra, extra long pour. A standard drink at Dickens would be a double anywhere else. A double would leave you cross-eyed. A triple would cream your spinach, according to my mother's younger brother, my Uncle Charlie, the first bartender Steve ever hired. Everyone has a holy place, a refuge where their heart is purer, their mind clearer, where they feel closer to God or love or truth or whatever it is they happen to worship. For better or worse, my holy place was Steve's bar. And because I found it in my youth, the bar was that much more sacred, its image clouded by that special reverence children accord those places where they feel safe. Others might feel this way about a classroom or playground, a theater or church, a laboratory or library or stadium, even a home. But none of these places claim me. We exalt what is at hand. Had I grown up beside a river or an ocean, some natural avenue of self-discovery and escape, I might have mythologized it. Instead, I grew up 142 steps from a glorious old American tavern, and that has made all the difference. Every regular at Steve's bar was fond of metaphors. One old bourbon drinker told me that a man's life is all a matter of mountains and caves. Mountains we must climb, caves where we hide when we can't face our mountains. For me, the bar was both, my most luxuriant cave, my most perilous mountain. And its men, though cavemen at heart, were my Sherpas. I loved them deeply, and I think they knew. Though they had experienced everything, war and love, fame and disgrace, wealth and ruin, I don't think they ever had a boy look at them with such shining, worshipful eyes. My devotion was something new to them, and I think it made them love me in their way, which was why they kidnapped me when I was 11. But now I can almost hear their voices. Whoa, kid, you're getting ahead of yourself. Steve would have me say it like this. I fell in love with his bar, and it was reciprocal, and it was this romance that shaped all my others. At a tender age, standing in Dickens, I decided that life is a sequence of romances, each new romance a response to a previous romance. But I was only one of many romantics in Steve's bar who had reached this conclusion, who believed in this chain reaction of love. It was this belief, as much as the bar, that united us, and this is why my story is just one strand in the cord that braided all our love stories together. Thank you. Do we have time for questions? I guess there's a question. It's on the Pulitzer website, so or you could type my name into Google. It comes up fairly quickly. And it's a piece about the last place in America where descendants of slaves in great numbers still live on the site of the plantation that their ancestors worked. It's a time warp in the middle of Alabama. It's an inlet in the Alabama River. And great numbers of African Americans live on this piece, this bulb of bottomland. And I told the story of this amazing place through the eyes of one woman who is a remarkable woman. It's an odd place because even though it's remote and isolated, and even though these people have had very little contact with the outside world since slavery days, they've had these moments of glory and exaltation. They had this, for instance, this love affair with Martin Luther King. He went there on this cold night when he was suffering from the flu because he'd heard about this place and couldn't believe it. And only the New York Times reporter was there. The account is sketchy, but apparently it was just they fell into each other's arms, this town and Martin Luther King. And when King died, when he was killed, the mules that pulled his casket through the streets of Atlanta came from this little place, G's Bend, Alabama. The PS to the story is even better because I told the story of this woman, and poverty and abuse and racism were huge issues in her life. Since I wrote the story, the quilts of G's Bend have become incredibly celebrated. You've probably heard about them. And they're traveling the country in the form of this art show that has been acclaimed by critics as some of the most important art in America, in the modern 20th century since, name it, Matisse, Monet. They compare these women, these quilters, and their bold shapes and colors to the greatest artists of the 20th century. And Mary Lee, who did not have money for reading glasses when I wrote about her, is on her way to becoming a millionaire. So, yeah. I haven't written that story yet. So the story ends with Mary Lee not doing too well. But, yeah. No, Bill and Bud, unfortunately, have not come back. Uncle Charlie has not surfaced. A remarkably small number of people have really gotten in touch since the book. Now, the book's out 2 weeks, so, you know, I could go home and have a hell of a voicemail waiting for me, but which makes answering the phone all the time kind of an adventure. But so far, they're reading. They're arguing. I'm told my spies in my hometown tell me there are ferocious arguments going on up and down the main street of my hometown. Like, for instance, two men almost came to blows about whether or not Bobo's dog Wilbur in 1973 was brown or brown and black, as I described him. And just the idea of Cager and Smelly and Colt almost coming to blows over the color of Wilbur is just more than I can really bear. But Maybe so. Maybe I'll hear from these. These are not email guys, you know. I'm sure Bob the Cop does not have an AOL account. So whether I'll hear from them or not, it's one of the mysteries, you know, from here on out. I didn't meet my father in Denver. So half of that story was autobiographical and half of it was fiction. The front of the label is autobiographical. The back of the bottle is fiction. The emotions are real, but I never thought that I could write nonfiction about any of this stuff. And when I told my mother almost exactly 5 years ago that I was thinking about turning this novel I'd been working on all my life into a memoir, we were sitting outside. My mother's a deeply private woman, as you may or may not know from the book. And she also, her first credo is do no harm. I mean, she should have been a physician because that's how she lives every day. So the idea of exposing all these men, writing off-the-record conversations from 20 years ago, she heard me say that I was going to write a memoir, and she said, in the same voice that she responded to all my harebrained schemes throughout my life. It's that voice that, like, I just told her I want to sell cheese sandwiches outside Grateful Dead concerts. And she said, And how would that work? You're gonna write about Bob the Cop killing a man by mistake? And I said, yeah, won't that be great? And she said, well, not for Bob the Cop. And I said, well, I would get his permission, you know. And she said, you're going to write about Cager and how he's traumatized by Vietnam? And I said, yeah, I'll ask Cager. That shouldn't be a problem. And I said, no, I'll have to write about you, of course, you know, and the time, you know, my father tried to kill you and all that. And she said, So, yeah, it was... I wrote a lot of fiction about this, and finally one day I just decided I was going to have to hold my breath and tell the truth, and she did too. She had to. She's been sort of braced for this for 5 years as well. So, anybody else? That's what they tell me. Well, no, it's sold to the movies, but I've sold other things to the movies, and it goes into a very deep black hole. I would like to not see Nathan Lane anywhere at all in the movie. I had one story I ever wrote come to the stage or the screen. It was a piece I wrote about a kid who got drunk and he was in a terrible accident. And I got a call from a private high school in L.A. And they said, we want to mount your story as a production for our winter carnival or something. I said, well, you know, you're supposed to go through the licensing department, but all right, you're just a drama department. Just don't tell anybody I said yes, but go ahead. So a few months later, I get a call. Oh, we're so excited the play is done. We'd like you to be our honored guest. So she said, and there's a character called J.R. Moringer. So I bring a date, naturally. So there's a seat right down front with my name, J.R. Moringer, and guest, you know. And the kids who are in the production all run and gather around me like the Von Trapp kids, you know. And they're, oh, my God, they're so excited to meet me. I'm the author. And then the curtain parts, and the character J.R. Moringer comes on stage. And it's not that she wasn't a good actress. It's just that what really bothered me is that she was probably 65 pounds wringing wet. I mean, she was so petite. If they had to have a woman, couldn't it be? So my date was laughing. It's a tragic story of this horrible car accident. And my date is just, like, suppressing these howling guffaws. So that, I thought, was the end of that. But then these kids, these little bastards, sold to Showtime my story and went to the Edinburgh Drama Festival on the money that they... So my experiences with Hollywood lead me to believe that Paul Rubin will probably get a call. You were so good in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. We'd love for you to take a look at Tender Bar because we see J.R. Moringer in a bow tie. Don't ask us why, but... So I don't dare articulate a preference because the minute you say a name, they start thinking transgender. It could really, a drag king could really spice this up, so I don't want to say it. Plus, it'll just, you know, you sell it and then you don't think about it. You just do not think about it because, yeah. Is that an answer to your question? Yes. Next question, yes. None in the last 4 years, I think. I've been locked in my basement for a very long time. I've been the Boo Radley of Milwaukee Street, some have called me. Bill Husted came over when I was writing one night after being overserved at a local establishment. He was with some friends and nailed a sign over my door that said, "No one gets in to see the wizard." And put it in with so many nails that I have yet to be able to get it down. So Thanks for reminding everybody about my loneliness, Bill. Thanks. Yes, Virginia. To go back to writing for the newspaper, I had to file a story today to my newspaper, a 4,000-word story, which I have no idea what it says. But the New York Times, after the review ran in the New York Times, I got an email from my boss saying, "We'd sure like to get some of that saloon poetry into the pages of the Los Angeles Times." So I think it's fair to say that my bosses at the LA Times are a little impatient. So I don't have time to figure out whether I want to write. I just have to write, you know. And I will. Yes, it is the best thing for you. I don't want to lock myself in that basement again. That was scary. Don't make me go down there again. Anybody? Yes. Well, give away a little of the ending of the book if I do, but so what? There was a moment in the bar where there was a series of unfortunate incidents, and a bunch of us scattered, and some of the guys from the bar set up in a condo in Breckenridge on Boreas Pass, and it's where a bunch of us just fetched up when we didn't have the bar and we didn't know where to go, and I was there with all these ex-waiters and busboys and my cousin McGraw, poorer than I've ever been in my life, playing hearts and drinking generic whiskey, and we ran completely out of money, and it was time to get back into the business I swore I'd never be into, and we drifted down to Denver in Pokey, our Chevy Citation, which we'd bought for $400, with a stain on the back seat that looked like there'd been a mob whack, you know, more than one, and going down the hill, as we used to call it, we would see nothing but Chevy Citations pulled over to the side of the road with their... And McGraw, my cousin, would pet the dashboard and say, "Don't look, Pokey. Don't look, girl." So I went to the Denver Post, and they threw me out. And I went to the Rocky Mountain News, and they had a much more lax security system. And I literally snuck up to see Chris Cubison, and he was foolish enough to offer me a job. And I went downstairs, and Pokey, the poor girl, threw a piston rod right there in front of the Rocky Mountain News the day I was hired. And... Some of these rejects had to come down from Breckenridge and collect me. When they found out I had a job, wow, they were all going to move down to Denver with me. So that was the illustrious start of my Denver journalism career. Mr. Charlie Brennan, who made me laugh at the scene of a mass murder many years ago. Charlie Brennan, who made me guffaw. But I'll tell that story later. Yes. Well, I took my mother to Portland last week for the first official event, a gathering of booksellers in Portland. I had high hopes about how she'd be treated, and my hopes were exceeded by the way these booksellers greeted, embraced my mother. They asked her to sign copies of my book, which brought tears to her eyes. She signed copies as if she was signing a check to Safeway. They fell in love with her. They wouldn't let her move from table to table. One woman ran up to her and called her the Naomi Judd of Long Island, which I still don't even know what that means, but it just makes me laugh hard every time I think about it. My mother said to me later at the hotel, "Naomi Judd's insane. Why did that woman say that to me?" And I said, "She's pretty, single mother, you know, but she's why Winona's fat." I said, "Yeah, but she's tough. She's held up. She's durable. But she's crazy. I saw her on Larry King. She's nuts." I said, "The woman wasn't thinking about the Larry King interview. She was just thinking that she's like a friend to her kids. And, oh, my, forget with the Naomi and the Judd." But we also went driving along the coast. And there's a lot about driving in the book. My mother and I would be driving. And we'd be driving talking about how we were going to pay the rent or talking about what was going to become of my what had become of my father when I was a kid. And I write about some of those scenes. Or we would look when I was 7, 8 years old at some of the big, beautiful houses in Manhasset. So here we were driving again. This time I was driving around Portland and looking at around the Oregon coast. And suddenly on NPR was Maureen Corrigan's review on Fresh Air, in which she said the loveliest things anyone said so far about the book and about my mother. And I was driving, my hands were shaking. I almost drove through the guardrail. And it's a miracle that rental car did not wind up in the ocean. And I finally had to pull over because it got really, it was a great review. And then when it was over, my mother had just the biggest tears in her eyes. There have been a lot of moments connected with this book, most of them really rough, because I've interviewed her about the most difficult days of her life. But that moment was compensation for a lot of that. And it was magical. So I think she's okay with the book. I think it means a lot to her that people are reacting the way they are to her courage. I told her she was going to be the hero of this book at the beginning, and she did not believe me because she didn't think she'd done anything heroic. But single mothers are, you know, lion hearts, in my opinion, and she's the paragon of the single mother, and so I'm glad that people are seeing that. Yes? Okay. I didn't get in when I was 7. I was 9, and I was sent down for cigarettes for my hungover uncle. And thereafter, I'd be sent to get somebody, go tell so-and-so that such-and-such is looking for him, a lot of times Marlboro Reds. And then, you know, you'd be in there, and nobody would, you'd sort of observe, you'd hang around, then they'd throw you out. There were video games for a while, and I would play those, and then finally somebody chased me off. But my real introduction to the bar, my formal introduction around page 75, is when my mother and grandmother, afraid that I wasn't getting any male influence, and because I was complaining about being lonely, they asked Uncle Charlie to do something with me. And he was so insane that his idea of what to do with me was to take me to the beach with Colt, Joey D, Fuck 'em Babe, and, you know, the whole gang. So, you know, my mother had no idea because it was her brother. She trusted him. And then after we would go to the beach, we'd go to the bar and we'd hang out for a couple of hours, but it was never nighttime, yeah. Litigation against the who? No, there's no one in this book I want to sue. I want to thank everyone in this book. Thank you. Okay. Anyone else? Yes. Joe Watt, is it? Louder, Joe. People can't hear you. Well, Houston said I'd probably be the... He said I would be what? Top assistant manager of the department? I think I might have gone pretty far because I was really good at it. Lord and Taylor never quite saw a clerk like me. I moved that stuff like it was going out of style. It, you know, people ask me if this book was painful to write. The really painful chapter was the Lord and Taylor chapter because I think that I was born to be the best clerk in the history of Lord and Taylor. And Home Fashions never saw a clerk like me. And they're still talking about me at the Waterford Castle because I moved that crystal like it was going out of style. My hope is that the women at Lord and Taylor are still around. And you remember that they were like among the original Ziegfeld girls, so I'm not sure. But it was just them and me, and I brought the median age in the department down by about 60 years. And I hope that I hear from them, because they would give a special present every day for the best salesman or saleswoman. I was the first salesman ever in the history. And I won the prize every day, and then they despised me for it. It was terrible. So... yeah, so that's where I'd be. Yes, follow-up? The truth. That's what the Harvard professor told me, and that's what he spent a semester trying to teach me. There are great memoirs that are fake. Don't get me wrong. They're beautiful. They're novels in the guise of memoir. There are really difficult memoirs that are brutally truthful that nobody in their right mind would want to spend a couple of winter nights reading. It's that balance of the truth and entertainment that I was going for, but always, always keeping in mind his exhortations to be truthful, even when I didn't want to be truthful. I really wasn't sure I wanted to write about most of what's in here, but I just felt like every memoir I read that I regretted reading either was fake, like it was a novel, or else was some mixture of true and false that wasn't, you know, some compound that didn't work for me, or else the writer would just lie by omission, that would leave a lot of stuff out, and you would feel like this person didn't want to be honest, so why did they write a memoir? What was the point? So I learned from that tutorial to push myself. When I didn't want to write about something, I wrote about it anyway. I wrote about it faster. And I learned that the story that scares you is the one you have to tell. So me too. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
That's all for tonight's Authors on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Neil Gaiman, Robert Hicks, Susanna Clarke, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was recorded on September 14th, 2005.